I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Jay Kimmelman, co-founder of Bridge International Academies, a private network of nursery and primary schools educating the poorest students in developing countries, including Kenya, Uganda, and India. Bridge charges families roughly $6 a month for a pupil to attend school and uses economies of scale to keep costs low across its more than 400 academies. Jay started Bridge International with his wife Shannon May in 2009. They were classmates at Harvard University, both graduating in 1999. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica.
What does a Bridge International Academy look like?
Yeah, so it looks like a school that you would see anywhere in the world. It's just that we locate our schools in communities that, as you mentioned, have predominantly low-income populations, families who live on less than $2 a day. But it's a physical school with multiple classrooms and a teacher in each classroom, leveraging a lot of technology. So there's a tablet in the teacher's hand from which we can push scripted educational content to that teacher and collect data about what's happening. But then a group of very eager pupils sitting in front of that teacher that they work with all day long. Our schools start at 7:30 and go through 5 o'clock. And we do that 5.5 days a week all through the year.
How many students are there in each classroom, roughly?
It ranges between 25 and 50.
You take a very analytic approach to education. Your approach is called Academy in a Box. Can you describe that more comprehensively?
Sure. So we take an approach similar to what other large-scale global retailer service providers have done. So systematizing sort of every different aspect about what it means to provide education, from what happens inside the classroom to what happens in order to get a school to come into being. And so for Bridge, some examples of that are all of our teachers have tablets that run a custom set of applications, and we can deliver real-time instructional content to them. But then we can monitor what's happening in the classroom by collecting information about pupil performance and teacher performance and feed that back in a data feedback loop. So roughly every 10 days, we get 250,000 test scores into our system that then we can analyze and figure out this is where we're doing well, this is where we haven't hit the mark, and then have processes and systems to improve upon that. And we take that approach across the whole spectrum, from the inside the classroom to how we build schools to where we locate them. So it's a very data-driven approach to ensuring that we deliver upon our promise.
You refer to the model being similar to how global retailers think about growth. You're talking about like a Starbucks or a Walmart. Is that right?
That's correct.
You talk about the teachers having electronic tablets or Nooks because instruction is scripted. Everything is very standardized. And, you know, there's been some criticism as to does this thwart creativity? What is your response to that?
I think it's important to think about it from the pupil perspective rather than the teacher's perspective. So, we have scripted guides for our teachers. That doesn't mean that we don't have a very child-centered, very creative approach to learning. It's just that we're not having every teacher reinvent the wheel of the best way to teach, let's say, dividing fractions every day across thousands of classrooms across the country. Think about your very best teacher that you've ever seen in a classroom delivering the best lesson that they've had. Think about trying to capture the essence of that lesson so that many more teachers can do that. That's essentially what scripted instruction allows you to do and allows us to do.
So basically every third grade on a Tuesday in April will be learning the exact same material, almost verbatim.
Yeah, what examples are put on the blackboard, what type of assignments are given in the classroom, the homework that is used, the best ways to explain the concept that day, that's all standardized. Now, obviously, the interaction between that that teacher and the children in the classroom, that's, of course, unique to that classroom context, and that's why we very much focus on finding, vetting, and training talented individuals from that local community to be that classroom leader.
Just more on the technology front, even payments are tech-friendly. You know, people use mobile devices to pay tuition. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. All of our schools are cashless, meaning there isn't money that exchanges hands between our customers and the manager at that academy. Parents pay either by depositing at a local bank or making, as you mentioned, mobile money transactions. And then we've developed the technology on the back end to connect in real time to the banking system and the mobile operators, process all those transactions through a proprietary billing database, and then update in real time the academy manager's smartphone. So the academy manager has real time access to exactly what's happening with with the customers in his or her school, as well as all the academic and operational information. And all of this happens despite the fact that our academies actually are not live connected to electricity.
Now, this whole model works because you are using economies of scale to keep costs low enough to justify the $5 or $6 per month that it costs a family maybe making less than $2 a day to pay.
That's right. I mean, if we were to run a single school, we'd have to charge something on the order of $10,000 a year. But because we're amortizing these very large-scale investments we make in designing the curriculum and the technology and the processes and the systems across hundreds of thousands and soon to be millions of pupils, we're able to deliver this quality education for about $6 per pupil per month. And so that economies of scale is critical in order to both reach the population that we're serving and do it in a financially viable way.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jay Kimmelman, co-founder of Bridge International Academies, the world's largest network of private pre-primary and primary schools educating poor students in Africa and Asia. The first Bridge International Academy opened in the Mukuru slum in Nairobi, Kenya in 2009. Prior to starting Bridge International Academies, Jay co-founded EduSoft, a web-based education assessment platform with revenues of $20 million that he sold to the publishing company Houghton Mifflin in 2004. The students at Bridge International Academies are outperforming their peers at other schools in both math and reading. Can you provide some more background to that and why you think that's happening?
Sure. So essentially, a child at Bridge learns in 1 year what a child at a neighboring school takes 2 years to master. So our educational effect sizes are some of the largest seen in any global intervention. If you look across countries such as the ones we serve, you see teacher absenteeism rates north of 40%. In Kenya, more than 40% of instructional time is lost because teachers aren't in the classrooms teaching. At Bridge, we have less than a 1% teacher absenteeism rate. So first of all, we're able to guarantee that there is a fundamental delivery of instruction on a day-to-day basis, on an hour-to-hour basis. Part of that comes from the technology and the systems we put in place. But then within that time frame, how do you know that you're delivering the quality of instruction? So that's where our ability to deliver scripted lesson guides directly into the hands of the teachers and ensure that they're being delivered, that's a massive value for our customers, which is what we see in the education results. Because of the ability for this data to come back and forth between the classroom and our content designers, we're able to iterate on every aspect of instruction. We do A versus B testing to determine whether this way of describing a particular concept area is better than that way. And we can deploy that in real time across thousands of classrooms and determine which approach is more effective academically. And we can run those experiments in real time and in parallel.
So can you give an example of a data that your content designer might look at of a curriculum or a lesson for a second grade classroom?
Just to bring it down
from 10,000 feet.
So a few months ago, our curriculum designers had a hypothesis by watching videos of our classrooms. We have a roving video team that takes samples of our classrooms. So we have the video, we have the test results, and we have the scripted lesson. And there was a hypothesis that at the end of science lessons, we typically, just like many other schools, would have an example for the pupils to work on by themselves. And typically, we'd do that as an open book example, meaning that they could use the textbook as a guide. And our curriculum developers had a hypothesis that for a significant percentage of pupils, that textbook being open was essentially like an intellectual crutch, and that it wasn't forcing them to reach sort of deep enough for the material to really click. So we ran a short cycle randomized control trial. In 1,000 classrooms, we tested what would happen if after 10 days of lessons, we would pull the textbook back and not have an open book. And in another couple thousand classrooms, we would leave it open book. What we found, we got 250,000 test scores come in. We found that with statistical significance, pupils gain on average around 8% on understanding that content area by not having the textbook in the class. So now we now apply that to other science lessons of a similar ilk. So it's those types of learnings that if you can do that again and again, you're able to learn faster about how children learn than sort of anywhere else.
Now, we talk about these content designers, and I'm thinking of like Wizard of Oz, you know, how the wizard's behind the curtain. Where are these content designers helping to perfect the curriculum of these hundreds of thousands of students sprinkled throughout Africa?
They're actually all over the world. We have a team in Kenya, a team in the United States, and a team in India currently.
In the United States, your office is in Cambridge?
Yeah, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, we have a small R&D hub for both our academic and our technology team.
You have a background in education, a technology. Prior to starting Bridge International Academies, you founded a company, co-founded a company called EduSoft, which basically was a web-based platform for student performance assessment. How would you describe it?
EduSoft was the leading assessment platform company for K-12 in the U.S. So we provided tools for teachers, school and district level administrators and up from there to make data-driven decisions about the instruction that happens in the classroom.
Now, you founded EduSoft in 2000 with another Harvard classmate, Dan Yates, and you sold the company to the publisher, Houghton Mifflin. And it was after that sale that you and Dan decided to go travel the world. Dan went with his girlfriend to Latin America, and you visited yours, Shannon May, in China. And Shannon was a classmate of yours from Harvard, but you hadn't met her until your fifth reunion. Is that right?
That's right. We were in the same class, and we always joke because we never ran into each other, and our circle of friends virtually don't overlap. So we always joke which one of us is making up the story about going to Harvard. Mm-hmm. And when we did meet at our fifth year reunion. I was in the process of selling our EduSoft and then planning on moving to Barcelona for a while. And Shannon, whose background is in anthropology and economic transformation, was planning to move to a very poor rural village in the mountains of northeastern China. So, you know, obviously very similar paths. And so I decided to skip Barcelona and move to a small farming village in northeastern China.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jay Kimmelman, co-founder of Bridge International Academies. We'll hear more from Jay coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Jay Kimmelman, co-founder of Bridge International Academies, the world's largest network of private, pre-primary, and primary schools, educating poor students in Africa and Asia. Bridge International Academies investors include Bill Gates, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, Omidyar Network, and Khosla Ventures. It was in this village in China where the idea for Bridge International came to be. Can you talk about the genesis of this idea?
Sure. So Shannon and I were thinking sort of very big picture. For families who live on less than $2 a day in the village we lived in, families lived for less than 70 cents a day. What were their challenges? What were the biggest levers to make an impact on quality of life, both for an individual or an individual family, but then at scale? And came to the conclusion that basic primary education was one of the biggest levers that you could have, both for an individual, but also at scale. There were a few different examples in the village that really brought this point home. So, you know, you could walk down the path in the village and look at different people's homes, and based upon the construction quality, what they were made out of, what the windows were made out of, you could then see a strong correlation between literally the quality of the construction of people's houses and whether they had access to a basic quality education. We lived next door to an old gentleman named Lao He. And he was a 70-year-old man who for most of his life had, for livelihood, had raised cashmere goats for their cashmere and sold that off. But due to his age, he was no longer able physically to do that. And so he recognized that if he wasn't able to change his livelihood, that would be the end. This gentleman, though, happened to be one of the individuals due to the previous communist era who had access and had gone successfully through a basic primary education. This man had a daughter in a nearby village, and he asked his daughter to buy him a book on how to rear smaller animals that didn't need so much tending. He figured out that if you raise foxes and other small animals, how much input costs there were, what would be the profit of that, how much he could sell his current goats for. And he essentially built an entirely new business model for his life. And we watched this transformation happen successfully. And if he didn't have the ability to read with real comprehension, to do the basic math and problem solving that it was needed to basically figure out this life critical example, that could have been the end of a prosperous life for this man. Mm-hmm. And so seeing that really in many ways hit home, just that, you know, basic education isn't just sort of, you know, we need to do it because that's what society says to do, but these are life critical skills and fundamentally alter someone's potential. So we started digging into that area much more deeply.
What was going on personally? I mean, here you are, you moved to rural China with a girlfriend whom you met very recently to a completely different job in a way. Was this like, oh, what a nice adventure? Just the whole experience of, you know,
sure.
Here you're in this high-tech, you know, venture scene with the sale of Edusoft, and now you're, you know, in rural China with a woman
you
love.
Yeah, it was a pretty big difference to move to rural China from living in San Francisco. You know, the village we lived in was a real mountain village where, you know, in the winters you had 40 degrees below weather, no indoor plumbing, no indoor heating. When I moved to China, I didn't speak a word of Chinese, and no one in the village obviously spoke a word of English. So that was a big challenge. I was essentially the village mute for the first period of time. There were a lot of very interesting learning experiences through that. I remember having a lunch early on with a group of men from the village who had sort of cajoled me into coming to lunch at one of their homes. And when you're living in such cold environments, drinking the local 140-proof grain alcohol is the common practice. This three meals a day. And I remember getting to the end of the lunch, and the only word that I had known at that point was the word for enough. So at one point, I, you know, enough of the alcohol or enough of the lunch. And then realizing towards the end of the meal that I was actually having this lunch, this very boozy lunch, with the teachers of the local primary school. And it was a weekday, and school was still in session. And so, you know, some of these experiences were actually some of the ones that, you know, led us to understand some of the challenges that families face who, you know, are trying to access the education. But for me personally, you know, it was really about learning what is life like for a large fraction of the world's population, but learning it personally, right? Mm-hmm. What is it like to have to go and get the wood for the fire, and how much time does it actually take to do the basics of keeping warm and feeding yourself? A lot of my friends and family were asking, well, we understand Shannon's finishing off her doctoral dissertation. What do you do all day? You don't technically have a job there. What is it that you do all day? And, you know, the answer is really everything that it takes to live and survive, right? For families who live in these communities, there is an enormous amount that it takes to just do the basics. And that, in many ways, was the experience that we were living.
And this, by the way, is a Jewish kid from Long Island, New York. Your first school you built actually in Nairobi in the Mukuru slum, which was in 2009. Why did you choose Kenya specifically?
As an organization, as a company, we're very data-driven, and we started out that way. So once we had developed and designed the sort of basic business model for Bridge, the next question was, where would be the best place to start, knowing that we were always looking to be a global player. So we took about 25 countries across Africa and elsewhere and identified what we thought were the five or six key business drivers that would make success in the first country. Things like overall population size, population density, broad acceptance of private schooling, and a few others. And we created a spreadsheet. Kenya came to the top of the list, so we bought our airplane tickets and moved to Kenya.
Without ever having been there before, you just kind of...
We had done research in a few countries, so we had been there before from a research perspective, but not from a living perspective. When Shannon and I got married, we had an extended honeymoon throughout Africa, of which a significant portion, if not the majority, was actually doing a lot of firsthand primary research in the communities that that we were thinking about serving.
Well, Shannon and you knew that you wanted to be life partners. How did you know that you wanted to embark on a professional career together? Was that just an easy, obvious choice?
You know, I think it came from a shared passion around the type of work we wanted to do and the type of impact that we wanted to have. It wasn't sort of a grand plan when, we were on our first date in San Francisco. But, I think when the stars aligned, you go for it. And, it's been an incredible journey ever since.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jay Kimmelman, co-founder of Bridge International Academies, the world's largest network of private pre-primary and primary schools, educating poor students in Africa and Asia. Bridge International Academy's investors include Bill Gates, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, Omidyar Network, and Khosla Ventures. I want to talk about raising capital. You decided instead of it being a nonprofit endeavor that this would be a for-profit company. What was the posture of investors to your idea of global, of retailing, basically, education?
Initially?
Yeah, initially.
Yeah, it was a pretty difficult road. I thought that given my history of, running and starting and selling a successful startup, that road to fundraising might be a bit easier. But given the if you will, the craziness of the idea and the scale of the idea, I think it was a pretty tough climb. I mean, first we were starting a business to provide education for the poorest families on the planet, and to get people to understand that poor customers are no different than wealthy customers. The only difference is that they have less money. Was a big challenge, and that they spend money on education, a huge challenge in terms of getting people to understand that. I mean, despite the fact that families who live on less than $2 a day, they currently spend $50 billion a year on nursery and primary school. That was something that was very difficult to get across. And then when you add into that we were going to then run the world's largest chain of schools done anywhere in the world in some of the toughest business climates. And because of the lack of infrastructure in our communities and countries we were going to work, we were going to have to be completely vertically integrated. We were going to have to build our own construction company, our own real estate acquisition company, run our own call center, do our own publishing and printing. In many ways, the idea was just too big for people to sort of grapple with, particularly sort of at the idea stage. So it was a pretty big hurdle. Initially, we funded the company ourselves.
Now, was there one or two early investors that opened the floodgates for you? Who was that first or one or two believers?
So our earliest large-scale investor was Omidyar. So the Omidyar Network, which was founded by Pierre Omidyar, the founder of eBay, was our initial largest sort of anchor investor. And they saw, they had made a specific decision that they were going to focus on markets and customers like the ones that we were going to serve. And obviously, Pierre, through his eBay experiences, understood the power and economies of scale and the power of technology to make a market much more servable. And then as we started to scale out, education-focused investors such as Learn Capital, and then large-scale venture firms who see huge market potential and teams that have proven the ability to execute, like NEA and Khosla, were able to see, wow, there's a $50 billion market and only one provider that has any credible story about providing this. That's a pretty attractive opportunity.
Did you have self-doubt in the early days when you had all this all the skepticism, and you'd go back to Kenya and you would try to, construct that first school without electricity and get those first customers? And from a granular perspective, were you like, wow, this is more of a forced march than I had anticipated, because you didn't have experience on the ground in Kenya ever?
Yeah, it was of course a challenge in the beginning. I think the challenges, like you mentioned, of, oh wow, how are we going to build a school at this price point, or why do the stones keep get stolen from the construction site, or how are we going to get the title searches done to figure out that we have the rights to this plot of land, or all of those sort of operational challenges were very real. The thing that continued that gave us and continues to give us so much confidence is just when you go into our communities and talk to the customers, the families that we serve, or early on the families we wanted to serve, just the the amount of focus and energy and passion they have about what they want for their kids, and that education is going to be and is their priority of what they do with their household budget. It was always so clear that there was such a need and such a market that already existed that you could do a lot better serving. That was probably the most sustaining sort of element of why this made sense and why it was obvious that something was going to be possible.
Now, what other problems arose that were just so outside of your realm of imagination?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, we work in very difficult business climates, right, where competitive business practices include leveling claims of devil worshiping on new businesses, right? It's not particular to Bridge, but that's the standard of competitive business practices in a community. You know, I remember being with a group of parents who talked about this, and you know, they said, "Well, how do we know that that you're not a group of people who devil worship and try to sacrifice and eat our children?" And I'd say, "Have any children been eaten?" Mm-hmm. You know, just really bringing it back down to the details about, you know, what it is we were there to do, what have we done, are, you know, folks happy with the quality of the education, yes, and sort of, you know, dealing with it as a practical matter. The bigger challenges, though, that we faced on the ground were things, such as how do you construct schools at the right price point and so quickly? We currently build a school from start to finish in about 14 calendar days. So how do you line up a supply chain and the logistics and the local labor and all those pieces to put together? And, you know, all of it's about a lot of details and a lot of processes, from how you find teachers to how you train them to how you build it, how you run the supply chain. So it's really mostly about getting in there, getting through the details, getting the real data, and doing the hard work.
Incidentally, I mean, you're most of the time in Africa, but you do go back and forth between, you know, Africa and Asia and you know, Cambridge, Massachusetts, to the developed world. Do you have a hard time at all with kind of the adjustments, or are you kind of impervious to that type of shifting at this point?
Well, I spend 98% of my time in Kenya, and I've lived in Kenya for the last 7 years, and that's where my family is, my two girls. So in many ways, you know, home is Kenya right now, and yeah, I feel pretty acclimated to our life there. In fact, I tend to have more issues living now in traveling to the developed world than where we're more accustomed to now.
Like what?
Last time I was visiting investors in San Francisco, I got my first case of food poisoning in 5 years at a sushi restaurant. My laptop was stolen 2 days ago in Cambridge, Massachusetts. In many ways, you start to see more similarities than differences as you start to sort of be more a person who is accustomed to a particular life.
And you have two girls, children. You probably never expected, growing up on Long Island in New York, that you'd be raising two girls in Kenya.
No, certainly not. Not predicted. We actually brought the girls with us on this trip to the U.S. And I had to travel back from Kenya with my two girls by myself because Shannon had to go for something else. So two girls on a 26-hour flight is quite a fun experience. Chloe is learning for the first time about traffic lights, you know, what red light and green light, since we have very few in Kenya, and elevators and skyscrapers. So it's interesting to have to educate your children on a whole sphere of life that you grew up with, which is not the norm for them now.
What do you enjoy doing outside of Bridge? What might I not know about you? Are you a falcon expert? Just
growing up, I was a performing children's magician and clown, but not anymore, except for my own children.
Tell me more.
So growing up, started out as a hobby and then sort of became an amateur profession for a while through high school and into college. I used to perform at birthday parties and things of that sort. And for the very little ones, I'd get in my, you know, red clown nose and giant feet and costumes. And for the older ones, you know, my magic top hat. There were a lot of lifelong lessons that, you know, you learn from from thinking about an audience and thinking about people's biases and their perceptions, because in many ways magic is, you know, entirely based upon what people's biased expectations are, and from a magician's perspective, how you take advantage of that to amuse them. I guess the other areas, you know, that is, I guess, somewhat amusing or interesting is I was also a vacuum salesman for a little while, door to door.
Why vacuum sales?
It was after high school and before going to university. I felt that as I saw a lot of my peers sort of go down the obvious routes of what to do in order to impress sort of folks in coming into university or building their careers, I felt like it was the opportunity to see a very different way of being, a very different career path. So I saw an ad in a newspaper that said, "Hey, want to sell vacuum cleaners door to door?" And so I jumped at it and started doing it.
And what, aside from the, like, the Willie Loman, like, you know, making the sale perspective, what else was surprising about, you know, selling vacuums and, you know, that individual encounter with the potential purchaser?
I think mostly it was about the perseverance, about sort of how many people you needed to talk to. We sold very expensive vacuum cleaners who weren't, you know, naturally in the market for a very expensive vacuum cleaner. And, you know, the number of doors that are slammed in your face, or the number of people who ask you to leave their premises, although oftentimes not as nicely. But, you know, the ability or the need to sort of keep strong and keep at it, that I'd say that perseverance piece was pretty formative.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Jessica.
My guest has been Jay Kimmelman, co-founder of Bridge International Academies.
Coming up, we'll meet Peter Manning, founder of Peter Manning, a clothing company focused on men 5'8 and under. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.
I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Peter Manning, founder of Peter Manning, a clothing company focused on men 5'8 and under. Prior to launching the company in February 2012, Peter was a Tony Award-winning theater producer. Welcome.
Great to be here.
What percent of the population is under 5'8"?
25% of American men.
So why hasn't a company like this existed prior? You know, you see a bunch of fashion designers, actually, who are 5'8 or under, like Giorgio Armani, Mickey Drexler, J. Crew.
I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, it's an enormous demographic. It's incredibly difficult to get dressed and find clothes that work. I think maybe it's because this consumer just didn't pipe up and say, "What about me?" You know, they manage, they go to the tailor, and it's dispiriting and no fun, but, you know, no one's walking around naked. I also think people thought, how do you do it? There's a stigma. And people have tried. I was speaking to a customer the other day who said, "Oh, we're so glad you're doing this. It's my husband's just, she's so happy," and all that. And she said, "There used to be a store in Washington that closed." And I said, "Oh, really? I don't know. But what store was that?" She said, "Oh, it's called the Short Men Shop." And I was like, wonder why that closed. You know what I mean? I just don't think there's the way to do it. And I'm trying to do it in a new way.
Your company doesn't mention the word short anywhere. Is that a conscious decision?
Definitely. It is a stigma. It is a bummer in the world we live in. So why not sort of avoid it? I'm 5'8". I was having problems. I thought, if I'm having, you know, issues, then definitely guys shorter will. You know, one of the funny things is men who are shorter, sometimes I'll tell them that I'm doing this, and they go, "Oh, really? That sounds interesting. You know, I do okay." And they'll sort of walk away. And then they'll come back and say, "Hey, you gonna do polo shirts?"
What is so painful about making your pants a little shorter? What does it mean to have a company geared towards the 5'8 and under crowd? Is it just simply making shorter pants?
I don't think men want to shop. Mm-hmm. So they don't want to shop and then have to go for the second step of taking your clothes to the tailor. And also the proportion on things are wrong. So if you get pants shortened, they're still too wide at the ankle and they're too wide at the knee, and it makes you look shorter because your pants are too wide. So it's never quite right.
I heard that you wore a Brooks Brothers boys blazer for several years.
Yeah, you know, it's all true. I mean, men have had to, like, shop in the boys department.
What is a tailor tax?
I call the tailor tax the money, the extra money one pays to fix your clothes. You know, I've shortened T-shirts that are just too long, or polo shirts that are too long, or I've had to take sleeves in because they're just too wide. I mean, it's really a pain. Mm-hmm. If you care, mm-hmm. it's a pain, mm-hmm. and it's a lot of money. And if you don't care, you don't look good.
I noticed you talk about your clothes being inspired by, you know, New York City street life, like the subways, for example. What is it about the subway that inspired your design?
Well, it was about color. The mosaics in the subway signs are these beautiful signs from when the subways were first made. Burnished reds and deep blues and kind of great sort of hunter green jewel tones. And, you know, there's a stop at 86th Street and a stop at Bleecker Street I call Bleecker Blue, you know, in my head, you know. So it's that kind of influence.
Now, you're still in the early days of the company. I mean, you launched in February 2012.
Oh, yeah, we're early.
So you're going through the process of defining and executing. And what has been harder for you than you thought, even not very far into the company?
Hard is getting your product made and done. And, you know, in factories that I'm a little pisher. I'm not a big gun yet. So you're not a priority, and how to make sure that you get the quality that you want, that's really a struggle.
The name of the company is eponymous, is Peter Manning. How did you ultimately come to that? Was it obvious, or?
I was talking to a branding firm that was helping me, and I came in into a meeting, and they said, your name is Peter Manning. People would pay us lots of money to come up with that name, and it's yours. In the early days, and still, I'll respond to a customer and they'll say, wow, it's you. And I'm like, sure, yeah, we all pick up the phone around here. There's no, you know, we all are helping. It's all hands on deck. So I think having someone behind it who's felt their pain and who wants the same clothes too is really makes a difference.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the clothing designer, Peter Manning. Peter is the founder of Peter Manning, an e-commerce clothing company for men 5'8 and under. You've had quite a career shift. Prior to starting Peter Manning, you worked in theater for over 15 years.
Yeah.
What drew you to theater initially?
I did start in the theater. I wanted to be an actor. And I loved it. I mean, growing up, I always did it, and I loved it. And then it got hard, and I wanted to see what the other side was about, because I didn't want to just sit around and complain about how, oh, there's no opportunities for actors and they don't really want me and all this stuff. I didn't like sitting around talking actor talk. And I got an internship at Manhattan Theater Club, and I worked there for 2.5 years and ended up saying, oh, producing. Mm-hmm. There's plays, and there's this whole other side of it that I hadn't thought about.
You won a Tony Award in 1998 for Sideman, which was a show that you took to Broadway. A sideman is somebody who plays like in a jazz band, right? How would you just define what a sideman is?
A sideman is a guy who plays in a jazz band. He's a guy who plays for hire, you know, mm-hmm. so he can play in a big band, or he can play at a wedding. He can play, you know, he can play in an orchestra pit. He's just a journeyman musician.
Yeah.
And it was a play that I loved that I'd done at New York Stage and Film. When I left New York Stage and Film, I told the writer, Warren Light, I promised him that I would do the play in New York. I had no idea how I was going to do that. And every producer in New York had seen Sideman and turned it down. I knew that it would be a success. I just knew it in my bones.
How much of your memory does that project consume in your era of theater?
It was an incredible experience for so many of us. And part of it, just as we were moving from downtown to Broadway, our daughter was born. So it's sort of tied up in that as well. But Frank Wood, who played the father, was this journeyman actor who'd sort of been like a sideman, but an actor, because actors are like sidemen too. And he went on to win the Tony Award. Edie Falco played the mother before. I remember Edie Falco telling me at some rehearsal one day, going, oh yeah, I got the show, it's The Sopranos. I remember vividly thinking to myself, wow, God, Edie sure doesn't seem like the sort of taffeta dress singing type. Because I thought it was, I had no idea. I mean, so we were all kind of young and doing this thing we just believed in with all our heart. Mm. And it kind of, you know, you have this experience where you sort of put it together with tape and love and, you know, hope for the best. And everyone's working for nothing in conditions that are like you know, almost tawdry, and you sort of do it and get it on, and it works. And it just, I knew, and then moved to Broadway and then wins the Tony Award. It just, I thought, that's not going to happen again. So, you know what? Let me just put that Tony Award on my shelf and gaze at that and go home and take care of my kid, was sort of how it went.
Why did you make a shift from theater?
The easy answer and the quick one is that we had a child. And Andre, my husband, now husband, partner then, but now we're married, was the artistic director of Lincoln Center Theater. And I just thought there's no way for both of us to have really the careers that you need to have in the theater, because you have to give 110% in the theater. There's no other way to do it half.
How did you meet Andre?
I interviewed to be his assistant, and we had an incredible interview that where we both were like, wow, something was happening here. But, you know, it was work, so we were, nothing did. And I didn't get the job because his assistant didn't end up leaving, but he left a message on the machine saying, well, there is no job, but let's get together for dinner sometime. And I thought, oh, wow, he must have felt it too.
And then you worked at Lincoln Center after.
I did, and that was a little tough. It was sort of exciting at first because no one knew about our relationship, and then it got annoying and hard after a while. That office romance stuff.
You're not the first.
Yeah, exactly.
You and Andre have been partners, and now he's your husband since when? Since
1991.
And you two have had kind of a personal entrepreneurial moment in having your daughter. Can you explain that?
We wanted a child, and, you know, so we sort of stumbled on an agency that was on 46th Street, and we did. But we also, when I look back, I think, wow, we kind of were out there on it. I think we're the first male couple in New York to adopt jointly.
And we take it for granted now because you have a lot of single-sex couples adopting, but you were the first.
Yeah, there are no – Katie has very few peers, and we're in New York. You know, we were always kind of the only two dads around for a long time. Now there's lots of them, which is great. Mm-hmm. But she's a real trailblazer, too. So she's got to sort of blaze that trail, too, and explain all the time as well.
After you left the theater world, before starting the company, you went back to college because you hadn't finished college. You only had a semester left, but you actually went to 4 years at Columbia.
I did. And
focused on architecture.
Right.
So was the thought that you would go into a career in architecture?
Well, I kind of knew that I wasn't going to go into a career in architecture, but I knew that I wanted to finish this degree that was unfinished, and I knew that I loved architecture, and I didn't quite know where it would go. When I got out, a friend who'd been incredibly successful in real estate said, I think you'd make a good developer. And I said, really? What's that? And he said, well, let's go find something and let's do a project together.
It's in Nolita, which is on the Lower East Side.
Yeah.
On Elizabeth Street.
Yeah. It's a building that people can't believe is new. Mm. It's brick and wood windows, and has a kind of detail and kind of heft that buildings used to have 100 years ago.
So why from theater to architecture to clothing? How did you land here?
I landed here because I did the development. It was the same. I was using the same exact skills in developing the building that I was using in the theater. And I thought to myself, oh, I could do that clothing company that I've wanted to do literally since I was 10 years old. You know, there's a story. My mother, I was 10. We were driving in the car in Larchmont, New York, where I grew up. And I said, Mom, I want bell bottoms. And she said, oh, sweetie, I can't buy you bell bottoms because by the time I shorten them, they won't be bell bottoms anymore. Mm-hmm. And I remembered it as vividly as, you know, yesterday. And I thought, that's really not fair. It's like the proverbial bell bottoms is my rosebud. You know what I mean? So that's what I've been searching for.
Your earliest memories associated with knowing that you were gay also tie into a sartorial moment, a connection to clothes when you were a child.
Right. I have this vivid memory of my going up the third floor stairs with my older sister, who's, I guess, 9 years older than me, and saying to her, you know what I love? I love waking up in the morning because I can't wait to get dressed. And I had this mustard pair of, like, you know, sort of pants that I loved. I remember my sister having a face on that was like, that's weird. You know, other 5-year-olds are not saying that. That doesn't mean you're gay, but I mean, it was, so I kind of always knew. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I hid it and like lots of people did and came out when I was 21 and everyone I knew was like, oh, really?
You had this love of style and clothes, you know, from the age of 5. How about your parents?
My mother was really, you know, she dressed beautifully. you know, she knew that girl, you know, she taught at a girls' school and she knew girls were watching, so she would pride herself on not wearing the same thing twice for, you know, weeks and weeks on times. She always looked put together and always managed to, you know, look great on without a lot of dough.
And why didn't you start this earlier?
I don't know. It didn't occur to me that I could. I mean, at the time, our building did very well, but the real estate market at the time had just dried up. And so I was sort of trying to figure out what was next. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to try and start this. And it's like that thing, and that can happen. I sat next to someone at a dinner party who had a very successful career with retail. And I told her, I've always had this idea. And she said, that's a great idea. Hmm. Call these people. They're starting a like kind of consulting firm for new brands, and you should really do that. That's a great idea. Hmm. And so off I went.
When you initially launched Peter Manning, where did the capital come from?
I was able to get a loan, $200,000. It was the first time the bank ever gave a loan to a startup.
Hmm. What bank?
M&T Bank, mm-hmm. Because they believed in it. And so that's how I got started, because I was really at the moment where I was like, I can't, maybe I'm not going to pull it off. Maybe I'm not going to get there. And they approved the loan and I was like, we're off. Hmm. We can do this. But then it's like, well, now you have to go raise more money. But now we have a proven concept and sort of real growth. And people can go, oh, wow, you really are onto something. And when you're an entrepreneur, which I guess I am, I'm like the reluctant entrepreneur, sometimes you're so far out on a limb that you feel like it's going to break. You know, I've cried on street corners. Like, I don't know how I'm going to solve this. And then I remember that we're not curing cancer. We're just trying to sell some pants. Like, and you get through it, and everyone's going to live. And you know what I mean? When you feel so much and you want so much the right thing, you know.
Why have you cried on a street corner?
Okay, here's what. Chinos are a big part of our business. The chinos that came in right before we were to put them on sale came, and their back pockets were too shallow. Like, you couldn't get a wallet in them, all of them. So we had to send them back to the factory, and then they have to remake them. And they're like, ooh, sorry. I'm like, oh, sorry? Hmm. What? Didn't anyone ask? Like, these pockets don't seem right. Like, no one asked that question? And so I'm still waiting for those pants. They're currently in customs. I'm waiting for them to come. And so it's just brutal. I feel so deeply about my customer that it drives me crazy.
Your daughter, what role, if any, has she played in the founding of this company?
Well, it's funny you should ask. The New York Times did an article about me and the company in March of 2012. And at that time, she's in boarding school now, which she's an ice hockey player. And she'd gotten into the school, and we were going up for what is called the revisit, the weekend where you go and sort of go look at the school and decide whether you really want to go there or not. And that was the day that the New York Times article came out. Like, the New York Times article came out that morning, and we were in the car on our way 4.5 hours to New Hampshire for 2 days, and there was nothing I could do. And my BlackBerry is going ping, 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 ping. And I'm thinking, I can't go to this school and like be one of those New York dads with my BlackBerry in the corner when everyone else is trying to like look like, oh, yes, we love it here and the trees are so pretty and oh, so interested in this humanities class and wow, the gym's great and the whole thing. And my BlackBerry is literally going to explode from, you know, orders that I'm getting. So I just said to Katie, I said, young lady, when you get home, you are going to work. And we came home, and it was all in our house. Like, one day, a truck came and delivered all these boxes, and I lugged it upstairs.
In Manhattan.
And she, for 2 days straight, for 12 hours, just like pushing it out. We'd push them out. I'd run to FedEx and drop them off. I mean, it was absolute insanity. I mean, a great lesson for a kid to sort of go, wow, this is how it works. You know, and I can see, too, sometimes when she's like, you know, the business, and it's like the other sibling.
It's competitive.
Yeah.
Do you ever see people on the street wearing your clothes?
I have, and it's so great. Just, you know, guy in a shirt and a khakis, and I just, you know, was driving, going by in a cab, and there he was. And I was like, there he is. He looks great. There's a very funny story. My daughter calls one day, and she's like, you're not going to believe it. This guy came up to me at school and said, hey, is your dad Peter Manning? And she said, yeah. And she's like, why? And she said, I wear his pants. It turns out she has a crush on him. So, you know what I mean? The whole thing is too weird, but very funny.
It struck me that, you know, here you are the producer of Sideman, and Sideman being musicians in jazz bands, and your career has been somewhat of a jazz song, you know, kind of ad hoc a little bit, you know, going from, you know, this beat to that.
Yeah.
Have you thought about that?
I had never made that connection, but it does make a lot of sense, and it's true. You know, in jazz, I sort of pick up the melody wherever it comes from, and in Sideman, there's a monologue where he talks about his father playing, and he said, you know, he'd be playing the horn, and if a car horn blew outside, he'd incorporate that into his solo. And I guess there's a little bit of that in my life, sort of, here are these things, and he's sort of allowing them to give them life, you know, from a play to a kid to a clothing company to a building.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's been great to be here.
My guest has been Peter Manning, the founder of the clothing company, Peter Manning. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.